Welcome to Insights and Indicators. I'm Jason Thomas, Carlyle's Head of Global Research and Investment Strategy. In this podcast, I share our observations and opinions on the economic landscape, as well as insights from research being conducted by our team here at Carlyle. Today, I'm joined by Lauren Bess-Majan, Global Head of Liquid Credit here at Carlyle, and we'll discuss syndicated loan markets, credit risk, and what's on her mind as we begin to look towards 2026. This episode was reported on November 3rd, 2025, and the discussion reflects composite portfolio data and analysis of recent government reports that are accurate as of that date. Before turning to Lauren, a few notes about what we've observed over the past month. First, our portfolio data show clear signs that U.S. growth has accelerated. Our proxy for real GDP grew at a 2.5% annualized rate over the past 2 months, up from barely 1% in Q2. We can also infer from our data that overall U.S. corporate revenue grew by 6.5% over the past 12 months, and this growth looks fairly even across business size categories. It's worth noting that this acceleration was observed before the October FOMC meeting, when the Fed announced another 25 basis point cut to the Fed funds target rate and a December 1st end to its balance sheet runoff. Secondly, consumption has rebounded and forward-looking indicators of household financial distress have improved. The top third of households by income have accounted for a record share of consumption growth over the past 2 years. And while it seems that their spending has picked up, we've also observed a decline in the share of newly delinquent loans among lower-income borrowers. So while total delinquency rates are high in some categories, like subprime auto loans, for instance, the rate at which loans have transitioned to non-accrual status has slowed. That is, the remaining pool of borrowers is proving more resilient than some had feared earlier this year. Third, I want to talk about the fascination that many people have with data centers, AI, and what they describe as the economy's dependence on it. First, I would say yes, of course, the growth here continues to be staggering. We see 50 to 70% annual growth in affected order books, and that is, of course, measured from a progressively higher base of activity. And when totaling up the investment in hardware, construction, infrastructure, related applications, and power, AI-related CapEx is adding almost a full percentage point to GDP. So that's about 40% of the real growth we're observing, and that's hugely consequential, no doubt. But it's certainly not the entirety of the growth, as some suggest. And I think it's important to note that when looking at real estate and infrastructure fund flows, there are signs that some of this data center investment is really crowding out investment in residential and other forms of industrial development. And so this dependence narrative really implicitly assumes that if not for data centers, this capital would not find other projects worth funding. I think that what's more likely is that if data center development were to slow, we'd probably just see some reallocation of a portion of these fixed investment outlays elsewhere, you know, really similar to what we've seen over the past 10 months when data center growth has offset the decline in warehouse and green industry investment, like EV manufacturing facilities. Finally, I would just say the one area of concern is the industrial sector in general, and I would say Germany in particular. Tariffs have obviously narrowed gross margins as U.S. manufacturers and wholesalers have eaten the increased cost of foreign-sourced components, parts, and other equipment. We do see signs that the incidence of this tax has begun to shift. Last month, 62% of the time series we looked at showed signs of an increase in prices received relative to the prior trend. This month, it was still about 50%, even higher relative to September. So there is some effort to push on price here, to reestablish margins. But of course, higher sales prices have weighed on sales volumes. And for Germany, the issue continues to be energy costs and broader competitiveness. energy-intensive output from an industrial sector standpoint finished October down 20% relative to the levels that prevailed prior to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And, you know, I think that there was, of course, broad hope that the $500 billion stimulus agreed in March would spur a rebound in the space. Maybe there'd be a change in the composition of end market demand, but there would be a rejuvenation in the industrial sector. But that's not what we've observed as yet. And in fact, orders and other forward-looking metrics actually look somewhat weaker than was the case 6 months ago. So with that, I'm very happy to turn to Lauren. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, Jason.
So the first question I wanted to ask, there was the World Bank IMF annual meetings here in Washington a few weeks ago. And, you know, it was a time when lots of topics of discussion, of course, tariffs, US-China, lots of topics were discussed, but it seemed to come at a time when you just had some high-profile defaults. You also had JP Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon talk about cockroaches, the idea that, you know, my kitchen is immaculate, so I've never seen a cockroach. But from what I understand, it means when you see one, there's more lurking elsewhere. You're head of global liquid credit here at Carlyle. You have probably a better vantage point than anyone into the market. What do you make of those discussions?
Yeah, I don't think that the cockroach analogy is the right one for below investment grade corporate credit. When I look at our portfolio of names, and we lend to over 580 companies in the US, over 200 in Europe, you know, we're actually seeing defaults come down right now, not up. So I understand there's a couple high profile ones. Some may include fraud. So very interesting to watch the car crash. But when you actually look at the data in the liquid market, we peaked with defaults about 4.5% when you include out-of-court restructurings, which I think is the right way to look at it, last December, and we're down to about 3.5% today. So when I think about how people want to look at a couple of these high-profile ones, I understand the sensationalism around it, but the data is saying that we've actually peaked already. And when I say peaked, think about where we were in COVID, right? COVID, we peaked at 4.5% as well. So we actually probably just went through another default cycle, and we could talk about what types of companies defaulted there. And it's not that we're going to zero, but we're coming down.
Do you think that people weren't sufficiently apprised of how high defaults were? I mean, it's interesting that you compare it to COVID. Everyone recognized, you know, after the pandemic, and, you know, there were some zombie companies that sort of, you know, probably should have restructured. They couldn't sustain their liability structure. But to talk about mid-2025, or I guess fourth quarter of 2024, as comparable to the pandemic, that would imply a pretty high level of defaults. Do you think this situation where people just weren't talking about before and now they're talking about it, there's like a salience effect here?
So what I think is the market for defaults has changed. So it's very easy to say, well, actual defaults in bankruptcy, Chapter 11s, were only running around 1%. No problems here, very low compared to historical levels. But the liquid market has evolved over the last couple of years, and now most defaults happen out of court. So when you look at the COVID statistic, the in-court and out-of-court was about the same. It was around 4.5% because most things actually went into court. But now that there's been more and more out-of-court restructurings where debt holders are taking an impairment, so that says default to me, you could pick which of the two statistics that you want to quote. Is it in court, which, yes, looked quite low, around 1%, or was it inclusive of out-of-court, where it looks at 4.5%? Now, why is that? Usually, you see a default cycle being led by an industry. You could think about 2015, 2016, where you saw energy lead that, or some retail names after that lead a little bit of a default cycle. What did this crop look like? What led the way? And it actually wasn't an industry this time. It was a vintage. It was a lot of the 2021 LBOs that, you know, there were very high purchase prices. They weren't underwritten with the expectation that rates were going to go from zero to peak close to 5.5% for your base rate. And then there were some lofty growth expectations as well that not all companies were able to achieve. And when you put those things together with higher for longer rates, some companies not achieving their plan, we saw an increase in defaults after companies live with this higher interest expense.
It's funny when you think about 2021, we've looked at the expectation for year-end 2024 base rates as of June 2021 was 80 basis points. If you look at swaptions, the implied volatility on swaptions, if you look at the implied volatility on options on futures, the chance that base rates at year-end 2024 would be 5% or close to 5% was, you know, basically a one in a million proposition. So that is essentially what drove these out-of-court restructurings in your view.
Yeah, that's right. And when you think about forward defaults, which was, I think, your original question about the roaches, you know, to me, one of the best leading indicators out there are loans that trade under 80. That means there's something wrong. There's usually a high correlation. And after all of, you know, the spike that we've seen coming down now, only 3% of the loan market's trading under 80. That doesn't suggest to me that we're going up.
Yeah, I guess, you know, from my perspective, just looking at the macros, you know, that sit behind the credit market, again, you see 6.5% revenue growth. That's our estimate, but that's generally consistent with what you've seen that's been reported in public company earnings thus far. That's very strong. Of course, during the decade between the GFC and the pandemic, that was actually very rarely achieved. You know, during that low inflation, relatively softer growth environment, you had year-over-year revenue growth that was closer to 5%. And then at the same time today, of course, we see base rates that have now declined by about almost 200 basis points relative to their peak, July 2024 peak. And so this just sort of, you know, again, not knowing anything about credit like you do, it just seems to me that this is a fairly supportive backdrop for credit performance.
Yeah, if you think about rates being down for our levered borrowers, right, below investment grade credit, 175 basis points or so since the peak. Also, our market has repriced tighter. So most borrowers have saved 50 basis points on their interest expense on the spread. And then you go forward and say, and Jason, this is your expertise, not mine, but where are rate cuts going from here is another 100 plus basis points. That means that below investment grade companies are going to save significant amounts on their interest expense versus where they were a couple of years ago, which should be very supportive.
So I want to talk about some of the technicals, as they say. You know, obviously, the last few years, you've had enormous demand for floating rate products, base rates being high, total returns extremely attractive in credit, lots of fund flows in both liquid, your market, and as well as private credit direct lending. Now, given this changed attitude about where base rates are headed, what do you think about demand in the market? And are you expecting an equilibration between supply and demand, perhaps wider spreads going forward as there's actually more deals as base rates come down, perhaps less demand for a floating rate product?
Yeah, but let's talk both sides, the supply and demand side. On the demand side, what's interesting is this year, even though we've seen significant tightening in asset spreads, which tells you there's demand, right? There's demand there that's causing this tightening. We've actually seen outflows from the loan asset class, both from ETFs and mutual funds. So you've seen $7 or $8 billion flow out of our market, but we certainly have not felt that from a deterioration in price, and we continue to tighten. Why is that? It's because CLOs are the main buyer of loans, of liquid loans, and there's been a lot of demand for CLO products. They're floating rate too. So why is there money coming out of the floating rate loan market, but going in to the floating rate CLO market? And it's because CLOs look like they have extra spread versus similarly rated asset classes, right? So you're picking up more on spread versus other assets that are rated the same. And that's why there's been significant demand. Next year, where do spreads go from here? I'm in the camp that we actually do see them widen. A little less so because of...
On the asset side, you mean?
On the asset side, yeah. I think so just because I think we're going to see deal flow pick up, and there's been a lack of deal flow in our market, and that's really led to the significant spread compression you've seen. But over the last couple of months, you've seen some really big deals be announced, right? So it's not just a guess anymore that you think that things are going to pick up. There's actually an identified forward pipeline for the first quarter of next year.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I speak with Bill Conway on many occasions, of course. And what's interesting when you talk about the CLO liability side, that, you know, given the interest rate risk that exists, just, you know, not sure about what the Fed is going to do. There's a general sense that rates are going lower. But of course, we saw Powell hit some hawkish notes in the October press conference. We're in this data blackout because of the government being closed. We do see lots of signs of upward pressure on prices. Again, companies that have had to eat tariffs that are actually very eager to push on price, sort of test what their end market demand can sustain. And, you know, again, there's just this potential that there's a backup in yields that we don't expect, or perhaps this is an economy with a reacceleration, you know, where the Fed has to recalibrate entering 2026. And what we've suggested is that actually the credit risk, minimal as it is, on the AAA CLO liabilities is perhaps more attractive than the paltry compensation you're receiving for duration risk on 10-year and beyond treasuries. Is that something you ever talk about with investors that, you know, here's the risk that we're presenting to you, here's the compensation you receive, here's the risk you receive in these high-grade fixed income markets, sovereign credit, et cetera?
Yeah, if you look at CLO AAAs today, just to level set, they do look like they're part of the widest piece of the capital structure. Even though they're approaching all-time tights, they're not at all-time tights, where most fixed income products are at post-financial crisis tights today.
I mean, what is the spread on AAA right now, you'd say, like a ballpark?
So they're around 120 to 125 over. And we get a lot of that conversation coming out of Japan, actually. So how do AAAs look versus the JGBs of Japan? That is, at times, will be big indicator of whether they're going to allocate more or less to the asset class, because it's certainly how they comp it.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, it's funny, people get so excited when they pick up 50 basis points for a term premium, you know, on a 10-year treasury. And again, that used to be an average of between 150 and 200 basis points in the pre-QE era. So anyway, it's interesting to me that interest rate risk, duration risk, is something that people just hadn't had to worry about. And so you had this enormous compression in the long-term premium, in the compensation investors receive for bearing that risk. And again, now we're in a world where I think the risks are more symmetric in terms of slower growth on one hand, or actually, again, a reacceleration of growth, perhaps hotter inflation on the other hand. And I don't think people have yet really repriced their expectations in terms of, again, what compensation they should earn. You know, I want to talk about 2026. You're looking forward to a fuller calendar, it sounds like. What are you worried about? What excites you? Just looking forward to next year, what are your expectations?
Yeah, so I think one of the interesting things that's starting to happen in the loan market is more conversations around what AI means for our underlying borrowers. That was not as big of a theme a year ago. Now, I mentioned earlier that we lend to over 575 companies in the U.S., and I can tell you that I have had not one of our companies miss earnings and blame it on AI, or revise guidance down and blame it on AI. So that's just to level set. Yet, we are seeing some loan price movement when the credit is deemed to have AI risk to the business model. And so it seems like there's a lot of speculation, because right now it's not showing up in the numbers. Usually you have data and analytics to say, all right, this is the company that's going to win or lose. But it's unclear who the winners or losers are, because of course, every management team that you talk to says that they have an AI solution that's only going to make them more efficient. So I don't think we see a near-term impact to earnings, though it's certainly a medium-term risk for our companies if they are behind the AI curve. But what I do fear is that because of the uncertainty on who the winners and who the losers will be, the enterprise value multiples on these types of credits will come down, right? Which means your asset coverage or your loan to value can change based on that. And so that's something that I think is just starting to emerge in our market, But I do wonder how some of these companies are sold until there's more clarity, or what valuation they would be sold at until there's more clarity.
So since you brought up AI, one last question. With earnings season, there are different press reports. You know, the hyperscalers and, of course, others that are huge investors in data centers and in these AI factories, as they call them, they're still far away from reaching their financial constraints. Much of this investment can be funded out of internally generated cash flow, but they are starting to tap external finance markets. They're issuing bonds, and it looks like they're moving to loan syndication markets. Have you seen any of that yet? Is that something that interests you in terms of investment opportunities going forward?
So far, we've really just seen the service companies. It could be as simple as janitorial services, right? Things that are affected by more AI growth, but they're not building out the capacity. If I had a crystal ball, I would say we will see financings in our market, but right now it's ancillary services that are coming.
Interesting. Well, Lauren, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Jason.
And to our subscribers, thanks for listening. And I hope you'll join us for next month's episode of Insights and Indicators.